Let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, part of the Word of God. Ecclesiastes is part of the Word of God. And that means that if you don't understand Ecclesiastes, if you haven't taken it on board, you'll be living an unbalanced Christian life. It's part of the whole counsel of God. Ecclesiastes, as we've seen, is about life in a fallen world. The Bible begins with the story of the fall. To quote the teacher in Ecclesiastes, God created man upright, but mankind went in search of many schemes. God created man good, upright, noble, reflecting the very character of God. But mankind turned his back on God and went in search of many schemes. And because of that, because man thought he was better than God, God showed man that he wasn't God by imposing a sentence upon him. And you'll find that sentence in Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 to 19. God said to man, after he had sinned, to the woman, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. To the man, cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. And then eventually you will return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. So life is painful, and it ends in dust. It ends in death and dust. That's human life. And Ecclesiastes is an extended commentary on Genesis 3, 16 to 19. And we've seen that at the beginning of Ecclesiastes and at the end, we have the words in the NIV, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. The word meaningless is the Hebrew word abel, and it can be better translated vanity or even vapor. It's the idea of something insubstantial that's impossible to get a hold of, that doesn't last for very long, that's frustrating. All those are the ideas behind this word abel. And it's even been suggested that you could actually translate the word fallen. 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 Everything is utterly fallen. Everything is subject to the fall. Life under the sun, to use another of his phrases, life under the sun. Life in this world as we know it and as we experience it is subject to the fall. Everything has the smell of death over it. We die, we leave the world with nothing, we're soon forgotten. And that means that every attempt to immortalize ourselves through wealth or power or position or praise is an utterly pointless activity. We're going to leave it all behind. No one leaves this world a penny richer than he came into it. And everyone will soon be forgotten. And therefore, all our attempts to immortalize ourselves will come to nothing. And the teacher in Ecclesiastes tries to get us to face that reality. And Ecclesiastes is about making the best of a bad job, making the best of life in a fallen world. Now, in these middle chapters, as we've seen, the emphasis is on the frustrations of life under the sun. It's unpredictability. It's unfairness. He uses the word crookedness in chapter 7. We would like life to be straightforward. We would like it to be predictable. We would like to be able to say, well, if you live in a certain way, this will happen, or this won't happen. But the point of Ecclesiastes in the central chapters is that it isn't like that at all. Life is a complete mess. It really is. Human life in this world under the sun is a complete mess. It is totally impossible to predict what's going to happen. It's pointless trying to make any sense of it. It's a world, for instance, in which bad people sometimes prosper and good people often suffer. Verse 14. There is something else meaningless that occurs on earth. Righteous men who get what the wicked deserve, and wicked men who get what the righteous deserve. Look back to chapter 7, verse 15. It says the same thing. 7:15, in this meaningless life of mine, I've seen both of these, a righteous man perishing in his righteousness and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. And look at chapter 9, verse 11. Chapter 9, verse 11. I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. We would prefer a world where everything was totally fair, and where everything was totally predictable, where the fastest people always won the race, where the strongest people always won the battle, where wisdom and ability are always rewarded. Well, Ecclesiastes says, it's not like that. It isn't fair. The best people don't necessarily come out on top. Very often the worst people come out on top. Real talent and ability often go completely unrecognized and unrewarded. The people who make it to the top are often there because they've pulled strings, or they've just been born into privilege, or they've stabbed people in the back, or they've bullied their way to the top, or sometimes it's just sheer chance. They've just been in the right place at the right time. The race is not to the swift, the battle to the strong. Food doesn't come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favour to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Maybe you're a bit surprised to find that verse in the Bible. So life isn't fair. It's a world where complete rogues become celebrities, and where they're honoured at lavish funerals, which you would expect to be for the great and the good. Verse 10, I saw the wicked buried, those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. This too is meaningless. It's a world in which the fact that sin so often seems to go unpunished encourages people to sin all the more. Verse 11, when the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, the hearts of the people are filled with schemes to do wrong. If God was just to punish sin, clearly and obviously, then people would stop living wicked lives. But he doesn't. And therefore, the wicked become more and more wicked. So life is a complete mess. Don't try and make any sense of it. There's nothing predictable other than death. And we can't even predict when that will happen. Verses 7 and 8. Chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. Since no man knows the future, who can tell him what is to come? No man has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the day of his death. Chapter 9, verse 12. 9:12. Moreover, no man knows when his hour will come, as fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. It's pointless trying to read providence. It's pointless trying to understand what God is doing. It's pointless trying to find some sort of plan. Nobody knows what it's all about. Verses 16 and 17. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe man's labour on earth, his eyes not seeing sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. Nobody knows. Nobody understands. Don't try and find any sense in life. Don't try and discover some plan. Well, it's pretty brutal, isn't it? But it's true. This is reality. Ecclesiastes is reality. What about other books of the Bible? What about the book of Proverbs? In the book of Proverbs, it seems that if you live according to a few simple rules and principles, you'll be successful. Work hard, says the book of Proverbs, and you'll be wealthy. Give to the poor generously, and God will be generous to you. Train up a child in the way it should go, and when it's old, it won't depart from it. If a man's ways please the Lord, even his enemies will be at peace with him. It's simple, isn't it? Ecclesiastes says, well, it's not always as simple as that. In fact, there are some scholars who think that Ecclesiastes was written to balance out the book of Proverbs, which makes life so simple. Ecclesiastes says it's not as simple as that. You see, Proverbs are by their very nature simplistic. They're useful guidelines. They're bits of good advice, normally to give to the young, to give them a good start in life. And we normally expect that they will work out, all things being equal. But in the real world, there are plenty of exceptions to the proverb. In the real world, there are people who work hard and disaster or oppression sweep away all that they've worked for overnight. In the real world, there are people who train up their children in the way they should go, and their children break their hearts. In the real world, there are people whose ways please the Lord, and their enemies are not at peace with them. Just ask the noble army of martyrs. Just ask the Lord Jesus Christ. A man whose ways pleased the Lord, if anybody's did. And yet his enemies were not at peace with him. And so Proverbs are simple. And life isn't as simple as the Proverbs make out. And Ecclesiastes was written to teach us that. my voice seems to be going for some reason. I don't know why. Think about the book of Deuteronomy. Everything seems very clear in the book of Deuteronomy. The nation of Israel is on the verge of the promised land. And God says through Moses, if you obey me when you enter the promised land, if you obey me, if you love me, if you're faithful to me, I'll bless you. You'll prosper, you'll win all your battles. Your harvest will be good. You'll be the envy of all the nations. If you obey me, if you're faithful to my covenant, you'll prosper. You'll be blessed. Disobey me, be unfaithful to the covenant, and nothing will go right for you. You'll be afflicted. You'll be defeated. You'll get diseases. Your harvest will fail. And so on. It's there in the book of Deuteronomy. So that seems pretty simple, doesn't it? Seems pretty clear. Obey God and you prosper. Disobey God and it'll be disastrous. Well, Moses is addressing Israel as a nation. And certainly the Bible teaches that if a nation honours God, that nation can expect to be blessed as a nation. But there will be plenty of individual exceptions. Which is why, amongst the laws in Deuteronomy, there are laws which tell God's people how to make provision for orphans and widows and the poor who simply have to glean from other people's harvests or wrongly divorced wives. It's all there in Deuteronomy. God will bless the nation, but there'll be plenty of exceptions. So the real world is the world of Ecclesiastes. And it's very important that we understand this. But hang on a minute, some of you are saying. I'm a Christian. Yeah, and that means that you've got the hope of a new world where you will be set free from death and set free from frustration and set free from sorrow. But that new world isn't here yet. It hasn't come yet. We're not there yet. And meanwhile, Christians live in the world of Ecclesiastes. They live in this life under the sun. And many Christians don't actually understand this. Many Christians live in a Christian fairyland. Many Christians live in a Christian fantasy world, where if I say my prayers, everything will be wonderful. They don't live in the real world. They live in a world where everything is marvellous, where everything is for the best all the time. Ecclesiastes says, no. We live in a fallen world, we live in a dying world, we live in an unfair world, we live in a cruel world where Christians die often too soon and sometimes much later than they would really like, just like everybody else. We live in a world where Christians lose their faculties just like everybody else. We live in a world where viruses and bombs and earthquakes do not seem to discriminate between Christians and non-Christians. It's all very obvious. But because we don't take it seriously, when something bad happens to us, we feel God has let us down. If we'd only read Ecclesiastes and take it seriously, we wouldn't react like that. In Ecclesiastes, the writer is saying, this is the way things are. This is the real world. Not even prayer can change this basic reality. Prayer will help you face the reality. It will help you persevere through the reality. But not even prayer can change this basic reality that this is a fallen world. And the New Testament teaches this as well. In Romans chapter 8, Paul says that God has subjected this world, this creation, to futility. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the word translated futility is the same word. The word translated meaningless in our NIV, Abel, is translated by the word that Paul calls futility in the New Testament. God has imposed futility upon this creation. So this is a fallen world. Life in this fallen world, nothing is ever perfect. And there's an interesting bit of advice between verses 2 and verse 8. Chapter 8, verses 2 through 8. He says, don't even expect the king to be perfect. By the king, Paul would have used the phrase, the governing authority. Politician. Don't expect politicians to be perfect. In the Old Testament, the politicians were kings. And they had real power. Verse 3. He will do whatever he pleases. A king's word is supreme. Who can say to him, what are you doing? So you've got a king. His power is absolute. Imperfect though he may be, he must be respected. And that's part of our duty to God. Verse 2. Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Paul says exactly the same thing in Romans chapter 13. Obey the governing authorities. It's part of our Christian duty. Even though they're not perfect, obey them. It's pointless trying to bring about a revolution, verses 3 and 4, because the king has absolute power. Much better to patiently bide your time and wait for the right moment to change things. Verses 5 and 6. Whoever obeys his command will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every matter, though a man's misery weighs heavily upon him. Don't try and bring about a revolution that's bound to fail, says the writer. Hang on in there, be patient, and wait for the right time, and the right time will probably eventually come. And you won't get your head chopped off. In a fallen world, nothing is ever completely right. Now, some people can't live with this. If it's not absolutely right, they resign, or they opt out, or they start a pointless revolution, or they court martyrdom. Unless things are absolutely perfect. They call it being uncompromising. So you get a Christian who won't get involved in politics. Some Christians who won't even vote because there's no such thing as a perfect political party. Or you get other Christians who, in their quest for a perfect church, move from one church split to another. And that happens all too often. In a fallen world, says Ecclesiastes, we need to be patient. Nothing is ever going to be as it should be. And you can often achieve far more just by hanging on in there and doing what good you can when you can, rather than being stupid and silly about it. Just think of men like Daniel, who worked for a pagan government, Nebuchadnezzar. And when the right times came, he was able to put in his oar. He was able to point Nebuchadnezzar to the God of heaven and exercise influence in that court. Or think of somebody like Obadiah, who worked for King Ahab, one of the worst kings in the history of Israel. And Obadiah worked for him. And as a result of working for him, he was able to hide 100 prophets in a cave and stop them from being executed. Or what about Ebed-Melech? You've all heard of Ebed-Melech, haven't you? Ebed-Melech worked in the palace of one of those bad kings of Judah just before the exile. Can't remember which one. Began with J. Nearly all of them do. And he worked for one of those kings whose name began with J. And he was able to get Jeremiah pulled out of that waterhole that they put him into. And he sank into the mud at the bottom. And they put him there to die. But Ebed-Melech pulled a few strings, went to see the king, and had Jeremiah pulled out of his waterhole. There must have been lots of things happening in that palace that he wasn't happy with. There must have been lots of things happening in Nebuchadnezzar's court that Daniel wasn't happy with. But he hung on in there. He didn't try and bring about a pointless revolution, which would have failed. He got his head chopped off. Instead, he waited for the right time. Verse 7, since no man knows the future, who can tell him what is to come? We don't know when the right time will come. Verse 8, no man has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the day of his death. Even kings will die. Even great politicians will die. And they can't do anything about it. They might have enormous power, but they've got no power over the day of their death. And if they've been wicked, they won't get away with it. No one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. So there's a bit of good advice about life in a fallen world. Don't expect anything to be perfect, ever. If you wait until things are perfect before you get involved, you'll never do anything. If you wait for a perfect church, or if you look for a perfect church, you'll never join a church. Or if you do, you'll cause trouble there almost immediately. There are people who just move from split to split because things aren't exactly as they would want them to be. And the advice of the teacher in Ecclesiastes is don't be like that. Accept that this is a fallen world. Accept that nothing is absolutely as it should be. And just get on and do what you can where you are. Okay, so it's a pretty dark and negative chapter. There are two positive notes in the chapter. And the first positive note comes in verses 12 and 13. And it comes out of the blue. It's almost an affirmation of sheer faith. Just look at it. Although a wicked man commits 100 crimes and still lives a long time, I know that it will go better with God-fearing men who are reverent before God. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. The teacher says, I know this. I know this. Normally he says, I've seen this, and I saw that, and I've seen this, and I've seen that. He doesn't say, I've seen this here, because he hasn't seen it. He just says, I know. I know that this is going to happen. I know there is a holy and just God. And I know that he will somehow, somewhere see that justice is done. I know that even if a man commits 100 crimes and lives a really long life, somehow his crimes are going to catch up with him. Somehow there's going to be justice. And that's how Ecclesiastes ends, chapter 12, verse 14. God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. It must be better to fear God. It will go better with those who fear Him. It will go badly with those who don't. I don't know how this is going to work out. I don't know when it's going to work out. He actually says it doesn't work out in this life, so the only option is for some kind of justice in the future. And of course Jesus and the New Testament will throw far more light onto this. There is going to be a day of judgment. God is going to work things out. It is not... The wicked will not prosper forever. And there will be a judgment when the sheep and the goats are separated forever. So that's one positive note in the passage. The other positive note in the chapter is verse 15. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of the life God has given him under the sun. Now that's one of many similar passages in Ecclesiastes, and the best one is in the next chapter, chapter 9, so we'll be looking at that next time. But over and over again in Ecclesiastes, the writer says something like this. This world is a fallen world, it's a dying world, it's a frustrating world, but it is not a world that has been completely abandoned by God. God still gives us many things to enjoy. He gives us many gifts. He gives us many blessings. Food, drink, marriage, friends, work. He gives us them, and they are signs that He has not completely abandoned mankind. He has not completely abandoned this creation. And the message of Ecclesiastes is, for goodness sake, enjoy these things. Enjoy these things. They're uncertain. Your opportunity to enjoy them will soon be gone. Enjoy them now, he said. They're signs of God's favour and grace to this world, which he could have abandoned. Okay, so that's a brief summary of Ecclesiastes chapter 8. This is life under the sun. This is life in this fallen world, subjected to futility, under the reign of sin and death, which mankind is locked into. Is there no hope? There is hope. There is hope. There really is. In Romans chapter 8, Paul says that God has subjected this creation to futility in hope. In hope. In the same passage, he says that this creation is groaning. But he says the groans are the pains of birth rather than death pain. In other words, there's going to be life and there's going to be joy at the end. There is going to be a new creation which is not subject to the fall, which has been released from the fall, where even our bodies will be redeemed along with the rest of creation. You can read about that in Revelation chapter 21, when God will wipe away all tears, when there will be no more curse, there will be no more death, there will be no more pain. Those things will have passed away. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. Is this just a Christian fantasy? Is this just another Christian dream? Is this just a Christian comfort blanket? No, it isn't. Because this future has already begun. This future has already begun. One man, his name is Jesus Christ, has already been delivered from sin and death. He took our sins upon himself. He took our judgment upon himself when he died on the cross. And God raised him from the dead, and death no longer has dominion over him. On the cross, Jesus dealt with sin, and death, therefore, had to give him up. And death will have to give up all who belong to Jesus Christ. The new creation has already begun in Jesus Christ. So why do Christians who believe in Jesus Christ still have to live in this dying, frustrating world under the sun, subject to pain and disappointment and death? Well, for one reason only. The good news of Jesus Christ has to be spread to all the world, to all the nations. The nations have to be told of Jesus' death and resurrection and return, and this coming new creation. And the one reason why we've been left under the sun in this fallen world is that we might tell our fellow men and women the good news of Jesus Christ. But meanwhile, this world of Ecclesiastes is our world. Let's not try and escape into some kind of Christian unreality, some Christian fairy land where everything is for the best. There are things which are not for the best. There are things that are just awful. And we need to face that. So let us keep trusting Jesus, following Jesus, hoping in Jesus, remembering that the things that are visible are temporary, and the things that are invisible are eternal.